Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey, and Steve's not here today. Instead, he's been replaced by Neil Watterson. How are you?
I'm gorgeous. How are you?
Very, very well. Very well. You've been a busy little bee recently, haven't you? You've just come back from Bovington.
That's right. Yeah, I was doing a recce for the British Army Motorsports Association Navigation Challenge, which is Saxon Express, and it's on March something or other, March 15th, I believe, is Saturday.
Wasting no time getting a little plug in there.
I know. That's what it's all about.
You've been really involved in those events for quite some years now, haven't you? The British Army Motorsports Association stuff up and down the country.
That's right. Yeah, I've done them for years. I first started doing them as marshal back in the 1990s, helping out marshalling when they're on Salisbury Plain and stuff like that. But more recently, I competed. I think myself and Mark Savile used to do a bit. We worked together on Land Rover Owner magazine. We competed in 2007, and then after that, I did quite a few. Eventually, winning quite a few.
I was going to say, did you not get bored of winning them, and that's when you decided to organise them instead?
Yeah, it's along those lines. So I help organise them. I don't do the full organisation because I'm rubbish at like the paperwork side of it, but like routes and stuff like that, I'm not too bad at.
No, jolly good. I was going to say, there's probably a lot of people out there that aren't really familiar with like the sort of overall overall format, if you like, of that type of motorsport. They might have heard of trialing and comp safaris and things like that, but navigation events are completely different. They're sort of a standalone thing, but they're definitely something I would urge people to get involved with because they give you the opportunity to drive places you otherwise would never get access to.
That's right. I mean, you competed in Saxon Express with me back in the Discovery 3
Discovery 3, yeah, and blew the back tyre out and had to drive home on the Space Saver.
That's it, yeah. But ultimately, it's a way of, I suppose the best way of describing it is almost like, it's like competitive green laning, where you're navigating and you're using aerial photographs or maps or something like that to get from point to point to point. It's the sort of thing that every Land Rover owner can, or 4x4 owner, can get involved in. All you need is really a Land Rover and a navigator. And the navigator can be as young as, I think it's 12 or 13 years old. So if you've got a son or a daughter who's in the scouts or guides or whatever, who's doing things like navigation, you could do it in the car. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's really, really good fun. I remember we did the event at Bovington in the Discovery 3, which was great fun. And we also, what was the last one? Was that Salisbury Plain? We set out, didn't we?
Yeah, but we also competed in Salisbury Plain, which we won.
Oh, in the 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah, before it got rebuilt. Wow, that feels forever ago now.
It was a long time ago. And then we set it out. We set out the route, which I'd plotted the route, mainly using byways across Salisbury Plain. And we had to drive it twice in the day, didn't we?
Yeah, we drove it once to lay everything out. And then we had to wait, didn't we? Like marshal while everyone drove it and then drive around again to collect everything afterwards. And I'd become stroppy tired, Martin, and sort of throwing my toys out of the pram because we'd had no sleep. It was a hell of a shift, wasn't it?
And I think that route was about 85 miles, of which we did about 70-odd on green lanes. And so we had to drive that twice in a day in the 110, and we got a puncher at night, and we were not that far ahead of the vehicles laying out. Therefore, we had to get that changed in the dark on Salisbury Plain with an absolutely minging vehicle before they caught up with us.
The 110 was absolutely plastered, wasn't it? And obviously you only got one spare and the ground, it was flint, sort of flint base, wasn't it? So there was a very real possibility of picking up another puncture.
Yeah.
And the lack of sleep and the running around and driving, you're concentrating that much more because it's at night. You're still driving, harsh terrain with your lights on and off all the time. Yeah, it was. But that said, something you won't forget and a really, really, really good fun event. So yeah, 100%. Is there a website or a Facebook page or whatever?
It is. I believe it's armymotorsports.co.uk. Now, one thing I have to stress is it's not only to the army competing. Civilians can compete. I've never been military, but civilians can compete. You just need the basic MSUK license or Motorsport UK license, which is free to get hold of. You need to be a member of a club, but you can join Barma. If you want to compete with that, or if you say something like Leicester and Rutland or Midland Rover Owners Club, you automatically have the you can get asked to invite the club to be invited along. It's also the brilliant thing for things like 4x4 response groups, because obviously if you're in a 4x4 response group member, you might be tasked to go to places to help people out. This means it's sort of real world training. They use it for training soldiers about navigation and driving off road. And for a 4x4 response thing, you might get tasked to go somewhere, and this is exactly that sort of thing, and it really helps.
Yeah, 100%. And like I sort of briefly mentioned earlier, it's you've got the Salisbury plane, that's Autumn Leaves, isn't it?
Yes.
But the other a couple of the other events up and down the country, Bovington, and there's one up north, isn't there?
There's Leconfield, which in Yorkshire, that's in June, and then of course there's the big one, which is Mudmaster, where there's an absurd number of entries last year, something like, I don't know, 50 or 60 Land Rovers and bikes. On the motorbikes, it's only military serving personnel. And then there was something like another 60 MAN trucks.
Wow.
Competing. It was just immense. It's like, it's almost like a Dakar, but in, you know,
the Scottish Dakar. But we've possibly made it sound a little bit more daunting than it actually is. It's a really, really good fun. And do you know what? Compared to a lot of other motorsport, cheap as...
It
chips.
I think, I can't remember the price on it. I think it's about 50-odd quid to compete in, say, Saxe Express or Roadmaster, which is at Leconfield. And for Saxe Express, I'm going to try and make the route about 40 miles. So that's just over £1 per mile of your competitive mile of driving. And you think how much stage rallies cost and stuff like that. And this is, you can do it in your standard Land Rover.
I was going to say, even if you compare that money to a day out at a paying play site or trialing, the amount of driving you pack in on a lot of stuff, a lot of terrain, a lot of obstacles that you'd never ever get to drive in any other circumstance, because they're all, you know, a lot of them are on military training grounds, you can't sniff at the price. And everyone's really helpful as well. It's not like you're thrown in at the deep end and it's, you know, it doesn't matter if you do badly. It's really, really good fun.
It's just about the fun of it. And like the first time you do it, I mean, Helen Tote Wright, who writes for LRM now, she competed in last year. She said she wants to come back. She can't do this year, unfortunately. But you know, it's just a fun day's competition. And you know, I've as Martin alluded, I've just been down for a recce. We've driven the entire route. I drove down there on the evening. Arrived there, drove the whole route, and drove home in the 110. So it's not, you know, no damage. You just turn up, you compete, you come home. You might get a puncher, obviously.
Yeah. If you're a sane person, you'd probably want to book a cheap hotel down there so that you don't have to do an epic drive and the actual event all in one hit. But Neil's hardcore. But that's enough of a plug anyway. We'll probably go right back to the beginning, I suppose, because we go back a fairly long way now, I guess. I started on LRO in 2015 when you were deputy editor.
Right.
Do you remember back then?
No.
Seems like forever ago.
Was it before yesterday? I remember yesterday. No. I mean, yesterday's a bit of a trouble, though.
A bit of a blur. Yeah, you were deputy editor, so you did green laning and new products, which you still do now.
I do,
Come full circle.
Yeah, I now do the new products for you. So when we come to the product of the month, product of the week, I won't have a clue what it is, because that's well in the past in my world.
Yes.
Because I've already done next issue's new products, which you've now seen, and I'm starting on the issue after, so getting stuff together for that. But yeah, I was doing the new products and green laning back then. I still obviously do green laning, and from that point where I was deputy editor, I went up and became the editor of LRO. Which
what year was that? Can you remember?
2017.
Was it 17? Yeah.
Something like that. I can't remember. I remember the first cover, but after that, it's all a bit of a blur. And then obviously in 2022, I decided, I'm going to take a step back. At the end, a couple of weeks after I said, I'm taking a step back, they said, we might be closing the magazine. I thought, thanks.
It was a really weird situation because we did Newbury, didn't we?
We did.
We went to the Newbury Spares Day.
We took a Series 3 with a Sankey on the back, didn't we?
The old LRO Series 3, that's right. We stocked that up. Did you know that the lady who used to work at Mathewson's car auctions, you know, Bangers and Cash on the telly?
Right.
That Steve loves watching.
Yeah.
It's like the car auction place in Yorkshire. The lady who used to work there, Sarah, her name is, she now owns that vehicle.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I saw it on Facebook the other day. She was stickered up, all sign written.
Excellent.
Anyway, we digress. So, yes, we went to Newbury to sell a load of old, some quality land for farts.
Quality pre-owned parts.
Pre-loved. And that was where you'd already told me that you were handing in your resignation.
Yeah.
Then Steve, obviously, who I normally do the podcast with, came and found me at Newbury and we had a chat. And that's fine. I've known Steve. Like, he used to come to our show, the LRO show at Peterborough, didn't he? I sort of knew him vaguely. Yeah. And we had a chat and whatever, and I thought nothing more of it. And then the Tuesday after the Sunday of Newbury rang me up and offered me the job at LRM. And so the timing was really weird. So you'd handed your notice in. I'd been offered a job editing LRM, but I didn't know at the time they were shutting LRO, I don't think.
No, none of us did. No, we didn't know until, what was it, January?
Yeah.
I think I'd actually left the full-time pay of LRO, so I'd become a freelancer.
Right.
And then they made an announcement that they might be closing it. And, you know, I even put in a rescue bid, to say, look, I can come back and I can, you know, reduce the overheads. Because ultimately, what happened was, it's proper Steve world. We must talk about his 90 later on and how that's getting on.
Oh yeah, okay. He'll love that. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we can't not do a podcast and not mention that. But yeah.
So pre-COVID, everything was fine, and you know, LRO was making a lot of money from advertising. But then COVID hit, and of course, nobody needed to advertise because either they couldn't get the bits or everybody was just inundated with work. So all the workshops were full because everybody said, well, I can't go on holiday. I'll spend money redoing my vehicle. So nobody needed to advertise. And all of a sudden, the revenue just plummeted. Now, as far as I'm aware, I think that LRO was still making money. But because it wasn't making as much money as it was before, the company who owned it, Bauer, looked at it and said, actually, you know what? We need to do something with this. And the decision was really to close it. But then they took submissions from people to see about buying it, which unfortunately didn't go through.
No. So it was, I mean, regardless of what we do now, it was an absolutely huge shame that they decided to pull the plug on the magazine because it was, well, it was going over 30 years, wasn't it? It was a real institution. A lot of people obviously really upset that it was gone. People who had subscribed from day one, and it was, you know, I grew up reading it as well as LRM, and it was fantastic. And to be fair, in the relatively short time I was there, we had some fantastic adventures, didn't we?
Yeah.
But yeah, the number of people though that have said to me since, oh yeah, you got out at the right time, didn't you? We genuinely had no idea.
No, if I had known, I'd have stayed on and taken redundancy, but I missed out on it. Yeah. So, c'est la vie.
Exactly. There could be no more proof that we were oblivious to the plight of poor old Land Rover owner. But yeah, it's a shame.
That's what happens. And then obviously when nothing happened in the next month, or it wasn't bought or sold or anything like that, then Warner's asked me if I'd produce a new magazine called Land Rover Life, which we did on a quarterly basis. That ran for 7 issues. Just in case you've not seen it or you never saw it and you're wondering why it says Land Rover Life on the front of LRMs at the moment.
Yeah.
So, and that's what happened. So I ran it for 7 issues.
And still involved with it now.
Oh, yeah.
And like I say, you're still, it's funny really, because you passed off new products to me when we were on LRO and I've now passed it off to you. And I see LRM.
Yeah.
But no, it's good. And I mean, long live magazines.
I love them.
Yeah. That's the great thing about Land Rovers and, you know, the magazines is they're both analog things. People like to have a physical paper thing to read and, you know, obviously you can get the digital version, which is fantastic, but to me, you just can't. I still get the buzz every time the new issue drops on the desk at work. It's brilliant.
Yeah, there's obviously the worry that you've made a mistake in there, but that's, you know, part of it. Most of the time, you know, it's right. I was looking at the I browse social media like most people do these days, and you know, doom scrolling a bit, and sometimes I see some great pictures, but there's no information with it. You just see a picture and think, did that person take that photo? You know, or have they just copied it from somewhere else? And why isn't there any information in it? You know, why is it not telling us where it is or what the vehicle is or stuff like that? And that's what frustrates me with digital stuff compared to magazines, because with magazines, we generally give a bit more information.
Yeah, we do. And actually, you say about mistakes, that is obviously a fear, and we do try our very best not to make them. Generally, if when you buy a magazine, it's been collated, it's been read by at least, what would you say, 3 or 4 people?
Yeah.
And then read a final time before it goes to print, yeah, and then it comes out. You know the information and everything in that has been properly looked into, and there's none of this nonsense you see on the internet where you don't know where the source is from, you don't know if it's true. It could be written by AI for all you know.
Yeah.
It's all actual proper stuff.
That's it. Yeah, funnily enough, you could see more and more AI things coming out. Like when somebody has a picture, I think it was a picture of a, what's the Ezeon, the one?
Oh, yeah.
There was a picture of that, and it came out with some sort of AI-generated description, which wasn't right at all. You think, well, really? Now, did the person who's posting it not actually bother checking the information? But, you know, that's part of the problem, isn't it? Yeah.
Unfortunately. But, I mean, fortunately for us, people know the brand and they trust it, and they know that we wouldn't, you know, we're not into that.
No,
we do things properly here.
There's no point. Plus, you know, what's the fun in it? Yeah, we do this because we like doing it.
Yeah. And 100%. Another thing I'll say is with Land Rover Monthly and obviously LRO, when we were on that, it was all fresh content. Every issue had new stuff in it.
Yeah.
There's no recycled rubbish in our magazines. It's, you know, I'll leave it there. But
yeah. It's like with the Green Lanes, because I haven't done, well, if you have read LRM over the last couple of years, you will have seen a couple of features from me.
Yes.
I think I did the Yorkshire, no, not Yorkshire, I did Lake District.
Yeah.
And then when we did Strata Florida.
Yes, took the Series 3 to Strata Florida.
Yeah, pre-rebuild.
Pre-rebuild.
So,
which, again, as you'll hear, I can thank you in person for all the hours of help you've given up to help put that back together, because no one knows series vehicles like Neil.
Well, there are quite a few people who do, but
no one I know knows series.
Of course, one within like 5 miles of you.
Yeah. And in the same town to that, the same amount of spare time as you, who will work for tea and biscuits. But yeah. thank you.
Yeah, that's all right.
But in fact, let's talk a little bit about your Land Rovers, because you've had some quite interesting vehicles in your time. You've still got 3.
Yes. But those are weirdly my main vehicles now. The lightweight I actually bought for my son to learn to drive in, because I thought if you can learn to drive in a vehicle with blind sides, I use a canvas top, no power steering, no servo. Oh no, I did have servo assisted brakes, no ABS.
Yeah.
Then you could drive anything. And he passed the first time, and then subsequently took his trailer license to tow things with that when you needed to take trailer licenses. And yes, that worked. But my 2A I've had since 1988. So
what year is the 2A?
69. It's registered 2 days before I was born.
That's cool.
So, because a lot of people, like when they get to, you know, 40s and we've got a bit more disposable income, they end up going out and buying a vehicle which is their birth year and stuff like that.
Yes.
My 2A was my first car I ever bought, and it turned out to be a couple of days older than me. So it's, yeah, fantastic.
I didn't realise it was the first vehicle you ever bought.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
No, it's my first car, so. But yeah, I had that and, you know, couldn't afford to maintain it. And then back in 97, so I'd had it almost 10 years, and 97, I decided to rebuild it onto a Gavamash chassis, rather like we've just done with yours.
Yes.
But I was on a budget. I think number one child had just come along, so everything was done very much on a budget. And but it went together, and I drove it for till 2007. Then we put the 200 TDI in it.
Right.
And then it's just sort of like evolved. So it's got a breakdown crane in the back, a fold out Dixon Bake Tuckaway R. It's quite a nice spec now, because it's got the 200 TDI military gearbox, overdrive, obviously galvanized chassis. The bulkhead was quite good. It's starting to get a bit ropey now, so I need to do some work on that. And it runs 6.5 inch, 130 rims on it. So
yeah.
It just looks right. And it's got a Husky winch on the front.
It's full soft top at the moment, isn't it?
At the moment, yeah, with a purely metal
hip-duty boots. Yeah, I really like those.
Yeah.
Because That was a truck cab for a while, I think.
Yeah.
Since I've known it, with a 130 canvas, like the PVC hood on the back, I think.
A double cab, 110 double cab.
That's it, 110 double cab.
Because they're interchangeable for riding. You get rid of the goalposts on the back of the truck cab. But, well, I mean, when I first bought it, it was a hard top and ran it like that for years and years.
I think it's actually been most body styles since I've known you. I think it's changed hats quite regularly.
And it has had a station wagon in the intervening time and stuff like that.
I think it looked really good as a station. Well, it looks good as everything, but I think it looked really good as a station wagon.
Yeah. But you keep nagging me to paint it because what happened was that I was doing an event up with Land Rover Experience Scotland. And I thought, you know what, I need to make this look pretty because it was pretty shabby. You know, everybody says, oh, look at that patina. But basically it was paint peeling off.
Yeah.
And it was on one side of it, because it always sits facing the sun on the one side, and all the paint was peeling off. The other side was not actually as bad. But I decided to take the paint off so I could get it repainted. And then I took too much paint off and took it down to metal. And I thought, okay, now I need to spray it, because you can't stick paint to bare metal or bare aluminium. So I got to that point. It just basically stopped. That was what, a year and a half ago? Or no.
Yeah,
it would have been a year and a half ago.
It was a long while ago, isn't it?
It's 2023. So
it doesn't stop you driving it like that, though.
No. But like, at least it's aluminium, so it doesn't rust. I've primed the bulkhead bits, but...
In fairness, though, now I've stopped hassling you to come over here and help me. And once the weather warms up a little bit, that does need to be painted this year.
It will be done. And everybody say, oh, look, it's too pretty. But I'll still drive it down green lanes. And I'll still, like, drive into trees because I'm not a freaking driver.
Just inject some character back into it.
That's it.
Oh, do you remember when we went to Snug's Pit and it fell off that log bridge?
Yes.
That was an interesting
thing. You were guiding me across that, weren't you?
Not very well.
Well, no, I think it just slipped off because it was just slippery logs, wasn't it?
Snug's Pit is a fantastic little off-road site, which is generally just for club events and trials. But a couple of years ago, we went there, didn't we? A group of us. And there's like a Camel Trophy style log bridge over a sort of V gully, isn't there?
Yes.
And it was absolutely hammering down until we got there, and it was just an absolute washout. And we thought, oh yeah, it'd be quite good to drive over that, but the logs were like ice, weren't they? It was so slippery.
Yeah, and of course the it was designed for a Defender, and the Series has got such a narrow track comparatively.
And your spotter was an idiot, and it sort of fell in a bit.
Yeah,
but it was like
you were mortified that I'd bent the seal, weren't you?
Yeah. Oh well, I felt responsible because I.
Well, you were, but like.
Yeah, that was quite fun.
Yeah,
these silly things have we done.
And then after that, I couldn't, because it's such a steep V gully, I couldn't drive out, so I had to winch myself out to get out of there.
Oh, there was so much winching going on that day, wasn't there?
Yeah, because it was just so soft and so muddy, and it's just slippery mud. They use it, like you say, for trials and stuff like that.
Yeah, and winch challenges. It's it's one of those sites where there's a few bits that you could get around in something fairly standard, but really it's, winches and lockers.
Because you had the disco with the lockers on front and rear on that.
Yeah, I did. My old Discovery one, which had front and rear lockers. That did okay, but it was tough. My friend Matt was in his bobtail, wasn't he? Unofficial stag do?
I think it might have been, yeah. Oh, no, or was it the one after that? I can't remember.
I don't know. It's been a couple of times.
Yeah.
That was good.
So, yeah, and obviously we did start to Florida in your Series 3 before we before we took the bits and rebuilt it. How's it going now?
It's really, really good. Yeah, I'm chuffed with it. It's so much better in every way. I think that bulkhead foot being completely detached had quite a big, large bearing on the body flex.
Yeah.
Because now it's really nice and tight, new hinges. It doesn't rattle when you hit bumps. The parabolics soak up the undulations a lot better. I'm really, really happy with it. I'm going to be doing the longest drive in it that it's had so far on Sunday. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
What else? I think where I fitted new engine and gearbox mounts, the bell housing is touching the gearbox tunnel slightly as it is transmitting quite a lot of noise. But other than that, there really aren't any sort of teething problems with it.
Excellent.
It's fantastic.
Well, to be honest, the major components came out and they went back in. So it's not as if you didn't do any wheel bearings. You did some brakes, didn't you?
I changed the rear drums and shoes for LOF ones.
Yeah.
Which has so much better.
So because you've got the LOF ones and then on the front you've got discs.
Yes, I've got design, development, engineering disc kit on the front, which again is fantastic. No adjustment, no bleeding up the twin wheel cylinders, which is an absolute nightmare, or it can be. So yeah, brakes are fantastic. Clutch is really nice. It's got an LOF clutch in it as well.
The electrics all work still? All the electrics. Amazing, because I did those.
A spot on. Extra earths everywhere for all of the...
all power lines. But,
yeah, exactly.
That's right. Actually, funnily enough, you're saying about the foot on the bulkhead. One of the things we did last week, you know, me and Martin, obviously, for the purpose of the tape, we fitted a super-inch Husky to the front of my 110. So now I have it on the front of my 2A, one on the front of my 2A and one on the front of my 110. And I'm not sure whether the extra weight has kind of made things move, but on the way down to Bovington, the bulkhead was squeaking quite a lot. It might just be the hinge. You know, the bush on the bonnet hinge?
Yeah.
They squeak a lot if you don't lubricate them. And it might just be that. I just remembered that could be a fault. But it was like squeaking.
That's really odd.
Yeah.
We haven't really changed anything.
No, I was just wondering whether the chassis is not quite as strong as I thought it was.
Oh, no. I think
it's all right. It's 20... That was a 1998, very, very late 300 TDI.
Yeah. And one of the last, isn't it? Yeah.
It is, yeah. I've had that one since 2002. So, referring back
you
to...
You had a big year in 2002, didn't you?
I had lots of stuff going on in 2002. But weirdly, I've done an update in the latest LRM, haven't I?
Yes, 100%.
So that's if you want to read a bit more about the background of that, because it's just ticked over... Well, it was just a little bit over the 200,000 miles in my ownership, which is not too bad for an old Land Rover, considering that, like, yesterday I did, well, in the previous 24 hours, I did 400 miles, of which 50 were on the tank train here at Bovington. That's the sort of life it gets.
Yeah, the 110 is battle-hardened, isn't it?
It
is in need of a bit of love now, but,
a lot.
Yeah, I was being kind, yes. But... Yeah, you don't spare the horses with it. It's a proper do-it-all vehicle.
It does get used. It doesn't... I was thinking about it as I was driving over here to do this today. I was thinking that if I'd bought that vehicle, I mean, ultimately, it's worth similar amount to what I paid for it in the first place. And some people buy old Land Rovers investments and never use them. Whereas I've bought the vehicle... I've put 200,000 miles on it and it's still worth about what I paid for it, you know, give or take a couple of grand.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've had 200,000 miles worth of fun out of it.
There's not many other vehicles on the planet that you can say you buy, own for 20 plus years, and then, you know, use as a daily vehicle, a family car, a green laner, an off-roader.
A tow vehicle.
Do everything with it and it's still worth that amount of money afterwards.
That's it.
They're such good vehicles.
Yeah. Which is why, you know, ultimately, there's so many of our readers do hold on to their vehicles.
Yeah.
They don't chop and change. And, you know, which is why, you know, Discovery One's coming back into fashion. I talked about Discovery One's. When I was down at Bovington, somebody pulled up next to me in a 4x4.
Ah, I know what you're going to say.
And he said, I'm just listening to Martin on the podcast. And it was G-Wack John.
G-Wack John, John Luke Masters.
Yeah.
What a nice guy.
So you saw the 110 who pulled up next to me and we had a chat for like about 10, 15 minutes. It was brilliant.
He messaged me and said, I've just seen your mate at the service station. I was getting a sausage, getting a bacon roll or something from the garage. And I said, yeah, I know. He just messaged me as well. I sent him the selfie that you took. He was really made up. Oh, yeah, we like John Masters. Hopefully he's coming to LRM Live again in one of his fine vehicles. There's someone who's thrown themselves fully into Land Rovers. There's no stopping him. He's not picking another one up, he's restoring something.
Yeah, fun enough, I was talking to him about Saxon Express, getting back to that. A bit plug. Yeah. He said, oh, yeah, I've got a wolf in bits. And I said, well, you're not going to get that done in like 6 weeks, are you? But, you know, it's just another vehicle which he has, so.
Yeah, he's got some lovely stuff.
Yeah.
I like his Series 1. He's got it's a short wheelbase of some description, but it's a lovely thing.
Yeah.
Check him out on Instagram. You'll be jealous of his fleet.
Definitely.
But yeah, what else? What else? Talk to us about your ambulance that you had for a bit.
Oh, my ambulance.
I think that's an interesting story.
Yeah, I, I, I had an ambulance. Basically, I'd always work. Like a lot of people, I used to do model kits, not very well. I used to do model kits, but obviously Tamiya used to have a Rover 7 ambulance kit. In fact, they still do it. I think they still sell it. That and the SAS one, but I could never buy a Pink Panther. So I sort of always wanted a Land Rover ambulance. One came up for sale in Dundee. So it didn't sell on eBay. So I just dropped the guy a line. I said, look, you know, it's would you sell it for asking or starting price, starting bid, which was 600 quid? But he came back and said, yeah, right. So I said, all right, but booked a train ticket, took a set of toolkit with me and a sleeping bag, and arrived there. And he was amazed that I'd actually done it. He thought I was just taking a mic. And like, just arriving, like, because I'd asked him whether he'd get back to Peterborough, and he said, yeah, it should do. So I picked up from Dundee, drove back into England, slept the night on a green lane, then drove back. And then I put up my drive and I thought, okay, I've got it. What do I do with it now? And I think that was that was 2007 or something like that. I took it to the LRC National, which was Baden Hall. So that will tell you which year it was. Took to there and slept in it. Then again, I parked it up and thought, it became a bit of a shed. Eventually, I decided, you know, I need to do something with this. I changed suspension. And then I thought, I'm going to take it to Spain and do the Land Rover party in Spain. And as it happened, this was 2011, because the Evoque was being launched in Paris on the same week. So what I did is I took my ambulance, drove it in the centre of Paris, got a picture outside the Eiffel Tower, and then went to the motor show to see the Evoque being launched before driving down to Spain to do the Land Rover party in it, and stayed there.
That's so cool.
And all I'd done with it is I'd changed the Leyshaft bearing in the in the main gearbox. I can't remember it. I changed with that the weekend before, and then the night before or the day before, I suddenly thought, you know what, I've got to go across the Pyrenees. I'm not sure about this radiator. So I phoned around. RJ Land Rovers had a series radiator in stock. So I was fitting that at 8 o'clock on the night before, before leaving at something like 6 o'clock in the morning to get the ferry across. As you do, because you know, most repairs are done at the 11th hour, aren't they?
Well, on the fly. Yeah, what an amazing adventure. That was still a 2.25 petrol, was it?
It was a 2.25 petrol, yeah. So I think I'd put new brake shoes on as well. And so all I needed to do on the entire journey, which was about 2,500 miles, was just adjust the brake shoes. And that was it. You just took it gentle, enjoyed it, came back. Then I put it on my drive and thought, what am I going to do with this? Until friend Chris Morgan phoned me up one day and said, you still got the ambulance? So he and I said, yeah. So I sold it to him. He took the lovely purring 2.25 petrol engine out, stuck a 200 TDI, and immediately drove to Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic.
Wow.
So then he bought it back and then was driving it around and got hit by an Azdaban or something, turned over. So now it's a double cab.
Oh, right.
So, okay. Yeah, so it still exists.
Oh, wow. Still about.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good, mate. What do you make of these people who post on Facebook and say, I've got to do a 20-mile round trip in my series at the weekend. What do I need to take with me? Should I take like a spare alternator and a spare engine and a spare transfer box?
Yeah, it definitely needs it. No, I tend to travel light these days. The only time I had a wheel bearing collapse once, which I knew was happening because I could hear it and you could feel it. So I ignored it. And the other problem I had was I was green laning in Norfolk, and because the 200 TDI, the pulley is slightly further forward, I misjudged a big hole in the ground.
Oh, the crankshaft pulley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Crankshaft pulley is lower. I wasn't watching what I was doing. I turned to talk to somebody, turned back, and there's a big hole in the ground. Springs compressed fully, the axle smashed into the pulley and bent it, and then it was throwing the fan belt off. So no matter how many tools I had with me, I would not have been able to resolve that. But the thing is, just make sure your vehicle's maintained. Just service the vehicle and get used to it. It's a bit like you going to Malvern. I mean, I think the longest trip you said you'd done is over to my house and back, which is, what's that, 15 miles?
It's not far, is it?
Yeah. No. But You just gain confidence in your vehicle. Make sure it's serviced.
I agree. And actually, you've got to remember that once upon a time, when these were new, people didn't think, oh, I'd better carry 1,000 spares and a full toolkit with me. They were everyday cars.
Yeah, that's it. You know, you should not expect... You should expect not to break down if you look after it. And if, you know, and they were neglected.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time well, obviously, my vehicles, for the MOTs, for the ones which need MOTs, they get MOTs. The lightweight and the 2A don't need MOTs, but the lightweight had one last year. The 2A, I'll get one done soon because it's worth having a second pair of eyes because I'm not, although I know my way around the Land Rovers, I'm not a mechanic as such, not like you, because you're a trained mechanic, aren't you?
Well, yeah, but regardless, you could be the best mechanic in the world and still miss things.
Yes.
So to have it on a proper four-poster being properly checked by someone who does it every day is definitely worth doing.
That's it.
I'm 100% on board. I think MOT should still be compulsory. I don't think tank tax should be. Please keep that.
Yeah.
But definitely, I think it's a bit silly, really, because a friend actually sent me a picture of a Opel Manta that was regularly used on the road, and there'd been something had gone wrong with it. It was being recovered for some reason or another, and he'd sent pictures of the underneath of it, and there it was MOT exempt, and it was
there nothing left of the underneath?
Very bad,
and
I dare say, for you know, yes, your vehicle should be roadworthy if it has, regardless of whether it has to have an MOT or not. But there's always a chance it isn't, whether you think it is or not.
That's it. Yeah, I was surprised when that legislation went through because apparently, I think I was looking at it when I was on LRO at the time and when they were doing the consultation, I said, look, this is a bad thing because I think a quarter of classics presented for MOT failed the MOT. So they weren't... And my argument is that the MOT... You wouldn't put a vehicle in for an MOT if you didn't think it's roadworthy and it's going to pass. Because why would you? Why would you even think about putting a vehicle in for a test if you don't think it's going to pass?
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And and most of it was lights and stuff like that. But you know, we know what old Land Rovers are like and old cars are like with lights, where you know, as you said earlier, you've got all the earths, the extra earths on yours to make sure that everything works.
Absolutely.
So.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Shall we have feature of the week?
Go on then.
Right. This week's feature of the week is in the latest issue of Land Rover Monthly, which is the March issue. And it is a very, very cool Range Rover Classic LSE. Have you seen this yet?
I've only seen the digital version when I get it through and I can have a quick scan of it, but I haven't read it now.
Jolly good. Well, this is a very, very nice vehicle. It's owned by Land Rover Las Vegas.
Okay.
So they basically bought this LSE and decided that they were going to prep it out for overlanding. So desert, mountains, all the nice terrain they've got over there in Nevada. And a fine job they've done. It's affectionately called Camel Joe because it's yellow. It's not actually a camel colour, but it's yellow and black. So kind of reminiscent of a camel theme. Decked out interior. Roof tent, front and rear lockers. They've done a rather splendid job on it.
Excellent. And that's the sort of thing you'd want as a Range Rover Classic, isn't it?
Well, it's, yeah, I mean, they've retained, it's a soft dash as well, it's a late one.
Yeah.
They've retained all the sort of character of it, but they've improved it and made it, you know, a real do-it-all vehicle.
Fantastic. Because there was the great divide they had over there, wasn't there? There was Range Rover Classics back in 94, 95, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, it does ring a bell. That's kind of... I'm not all that familiar with it.
That's because you're young.
Yeah, I would. Yeah, I am. But yeah, this thing is mega cool. Check it out. It's got all the sort of not vintage, the sort of period correct mods on it, like a big ARB bumper and worn winch with the separate solenoid pack, and they've kept the look of it really sort of in keeping with the car itself.
Excellent.
So be sure to check that out in the March issue of LRM, which is on sale now. Shall we scoot seamlessly into product of the week?
Go on then.
Shall we?
Honestly, I can't remember what was in there. I know there's some good stuff because I collated it, but I can't remember what it was.
There's all sorts of good stuff. Yeah. This is a product after my own heart. It is a Freelander 2 front bash plate guard.
Okay.
So, Freelander 2s, as we all know, are fantastic vehicles. Probably the best thing Land Rover ever built.
Yeah, talk about that. Your one. I own that for a while.
Yeah, right, okay, we're going off on another tangent here. This was actually something I was going to mention. You bought that to drive to Spain in.
Yes.
Then you never drove it to Spain, and then I bought it from you.
I don't think I actually drove it, did I? Well, the only time we drove it was when we had to tow start it. No, we didn't even tow start it, we jump started it.
Okay, let's go from the beginning. The Freelander 2 that I now own used to belong to our production manager on LRO, Rob McCabe, who also wrote for the mag years and years ago, didn't he?
Yes.
He bought that from somewhere in the country, and he drove it for a bit, and it broke down a couple of times, didn't it? Because the crank sensor kept failing.
And you had to keep going around and get it working.
I had to keep going to his house and cleaning the crank sensor and putting it back on, and it'd be okay for a bit more. And then I think he kind of lost confidence in it.
Yeah.
We did change the sensor, and it was still playing up, so I don't know if there was a wiring issue or whatever. So then he
was going to chop it in for something else.
Yes, he was going to trade it in, wasn't he? And then he said to you, if you want it for the trade-in price, you can buy it.
Yes.
So you bought it.
Yeah.
To drive, because you...
I was going to go to... My daughter was part of her university course was languages, or she was doing languages, and she was living in Spain for 6 months. And so basically I was in Salamanca. We were going to drive down there.
Salamanca, isn't that a small Lisbon?
It is, yes.
Thought so.
Yes, it's one of those. So I was thinking, it's a long haul. We're not going to do the ferry. My wife didn't want to do the ferry. So we're going to drive right the way across France and then across Spain to Salamanca. And so rather than taking the 110 or even the 2A, which, you know, that'd be a horrible journey in the 2A, but I thought, all right, let's get a Freelander 2. And then, but as it turned out, I didn't buy it in time. He sold it. I was going to buy it, but didn't sort it out in time because I'd wanted to, what we were saying a bit earlier, I want to make sure it's all good to go, it's fully serviced, everything done, and I simply ran out of time. So what I did is I rushed up to, got the 110, rushed up to Noise Killer Group, got some sound deadening in that. What else did I do? There's a couple of other little bits I did. And then we took the 110 and we did a sort of 4,000 mile, 7 day trip.
Did you put the Ali Sport intercooler on before you?
Yes.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, to just to help it breathe a little bit better or not...
keep those intake temps nice and cool.
That was it, yeah. So it was the Ali Sport intake and the Noise Killer sound deadening, and that was it. That was the... again, serviced it. Drove it 4,000 miles in, I think it was 7 days or a week or 10 days, something like that, and that was it.
Yeah, so once again, the Mighty 110 picked up the slack.
Yeah.
But the Freelander 2, you bought it, then we sort of used it as a runaround, didn't we, on the mag?
We did, and then John Pearson, his Discovery, he sold his Discovery 2 or something or other, and then he started driving it.
Yeah.
Like, we knew there's a problem, or the first time I drove it, I knew there's a problem with the gearbox because it was downshifting when it shouldn't be.
It would occasionally flare, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
At high speeds, it would have a bit of a, get a bit confused.
Yeah. Which Rob didn't tell us about, obviously.
Sold a scene, no warranty given or implied.
Exactly. And eventually with, I think JP put, he must have put like 5,000-7,000 miles on it. And eventually the gearbox just said, nah.
The gearbox did indeed leave the track completely, didn't it?
It did. And so we had that rebuilt.
Actually, before we had it rebuilt, it sat in the car park for 6 months, didn't it?
Yep.
Gathering moss and looking very sorry for itself.
And lack of battery, because this was when, you know, lockdown happened basically, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just before lockdown or something.
Then it was a case of, do we just get rid of it or do we have it fixed? Yeah. And we ended up having the gearbox reconditioned by a company not far away. And then we did mag features on it, didn't we?
Yes. and various bits and replaced bits and pieces and stuff like that. So, and then you said you needed a vehicle, so I wasn't using it. In fact, I don't think I ever drove it apart from that first couple of times. And
I think I saw, after the gearbox was done, I kind of warmed to it and sort of adopted it unofficially. Yeah. And my Discovery One, I needed something that I could, because the Discovery was modified, and I wanted something basically standard that I could do long distances in.
Yeah.
And you said, well, I don't need this anymore. So yeah. I bought it from you.
Yeah.
And I've still got it.
Yeah.
And it's a fine vehicle.
It's proved how good they are. So, and I should have, you know, I think that had I bought it before Spain, it really was a case of not having enough time to prep it and not being aware, you know, sure of the vehicle. And probably a good job too, because the gearbox probably would have gone pop.
Possibly. But in case it makes you feel any better, the aircon still blows beautifully cold. I don't know how hot it was in Spain, but
well, in, as I found out in Salamanca, it's about the same temperature as the UK. You think of Spain being this really, really hot and sunny place, but like it was just raining all the time. And when I realized, you know, we were just driving up and up from where we crossed from France, and I was just looking at the altitude showing up on the GPS, and I think it was 1,000 meters most of the time, which is why, you know, you're up in the clouds. And you know, it's colder up there, apparently.
Wow. So there you go.
Yeah.
Let me just finish up product of the week.
Yeah, right.
Because remember, we were doing that about 10 minutes ago. So Freelander 2 front under tray. This is from wildbear4x4.com. It's £325 and it goes on the existing fixing points where the under tray bolts. Basically, it's made of thicker aluminium. And if you're going to go green laning, it's probably quite a wise upgrade because the standard under tray is made out of tin.
Yeah.
There you go. You can buy it from wildbear4x4.com.
Yeah.
Before I forget, you said about Spain, you actually went on the Freelander facelift launch in Spain, didn't you?
No, that the facelift. Hold on.
Oh, sorry. No, like, no, the one
I
wears.
I'm getting confused. No, the Freelander 2, I went on the launch of that in Essaouira in Morocco. So when the Freelander, we were shown the Freelander 2 before it was available to press. And then I went to launch in Morocco for that. So I've always been sort of a Freelander thing. But before that, what you're thinking of is myself, Tom Critchell, who does photographs for a magazine,
yeah,
and Roger Craythorne.
That Land Rover Roger Craythorne. Sorry.
Yeah. We took a very, very late Freelander 1. This was when Freelander 1s were still in production, down to Spain. Arranged with Roger. We sort of planned it, and we would meet in Malaga at about 8 o'clock at night on a day, and we arrived, we both drove across France and Spain, and we arrived within 10 minutes of each other using different routes. And then we spent the next few days. This was when this was launching the Defender Silver, so it's 2006 again, I think.
Yeah, okay.
So we're getting photos of that as well. And we did loads of the original launch bits from the Freelander launch.
I got confused.
And we did, you know, those trips in Seville or on the, oh, I can't remember. Basically, that was the trip which almost cured me of my, you know, lack of head for height, because there were some points we were going up the mountain tracks and you'd do the last turn before going over the top and there would be nothing ahead of you. You see the bonnet and there is nothing ahead. You just have to, I was kind of hugging the inside of the wall of the mountain and then just kind of looking out the window, just trying to see. But on that trip, you were saying about the air conditioning. This was in the Freelander one. We were stopped on a hillside. It was shown as 43 degrees Celsius centigrade.
So that part of Spain was hot as well.
Yeah, that part of Spain was hot. And Tom jumped out of the car. Actually, I was outside talking to Roger. We were thinking about getting photos on the hillside, etc. Tom jumped out, knocked the lock lever on the passenger door. And it, you know, we had the engine running and it locked the Freelander with the keys inside. Yeah, the aircon running, like keeping it cool and stuff like that. So we're sitting there thinking, how do we get in? Eventually, Roger had to phone Land Rover to try and work out a way of getting into the running vehicle, because we only had the one set of keys with us. So we eventually got in.
There, was there, there, was there, there slight damage to the vehicle?
We had to take out one of the rear quarter lights to do it.
Okay.
So there is a way of doing it, which I know now.
Right.
But we had to take out the quarter light to get it. And so as we eventually did the smuggler's trail into Andorra, and we went out and passed the through Duane, which is the customs or whatever, and that they were looking at. So the brand new Freelander one with a broken window or a taped up quarter light window.
Nothing to see here, officer?
No, no. So yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the trip I was thinking of.
Mm.
But I see you're wearing your Land Rover trophy hoodie, which I'm eternally jealous of. And actually, you left your Land Rover trophy cap in my Freelander 2 for quite some time, and I was almost tempted to not tell you it was in there because I wanted to keep it.
Yeah.
But that must have been a cool experience.
That was brilliant. This was the first Land Rover trophy, because they've done...
They did two versions, didn't they?
Yeah, they did the first one, which is in Eastern Yellow, which is very Camel Trophy, almost Camel Trophy colours.
Yes.
Very close to Anglo.
So if you want to get fully up to speed with all of the limited editions in this vein, check out our YouTube channel, because I went and drove one of the bespoke range at JLR Classic, and I talk a little bit about the different models in Land Rover's 5-litre V8 powered Defender series, if you like. But the Trophy 1, as you say, is the sort of camel-esque version, wasn't it?
That's
and then they
it.
Did a snow camo one afterwards, which is Trophy 2.
Yeah, yep. And have they done any since?
I don't think they've done any more trophy.
Not
they did
yet.
The Isla, which was...
Yes.
And then they just do bespoke now. I don't believe there's any more trophy.
They probably can't with some things. But yeah, this one was... this was designed... COVID played so many problems, or caused so many problems. And originally it was meant to be... If you bought the Trophy Defender, which started at £195,000, I think, for the 90 version, going up to £210,000 for the 110, plus whatever extra you wanted. If you bought one, you got 2 or 3 days driving at Eastner with the D3 events team, they're the guys who did G4 and, you know, before that were involved with the organisation of Camel Trophy. And we did all sorts of things like driving. Anyway, myself and Patrick, who was then the editor of LRM, we teamed up, or we got invited along to drive them. So we had the company V8, V890, I think it was.
Yeah, it was a 9
drive. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we spent 3 days in Eastner, based at the Cottage in the Wood Hotel, which bizarrely was the same hotel I stayed in on my honeymoon. Yeah, so it's like everything's
this is a story in that by itself, probably one that we won't get into.
No, but I was driving my lightweight back in those days. We went on a honeymoon in my lightweight, but anyway, we spent 3 days at Eastner, and honestly, you know, people can't look at them and go, oh, yeah, these the trophy editions, they're bought by people who don't really understand Land Rover. But the guys were from all over the world, and they really got into it. They were, you know, obviously there's a few quid kicking around, but they were doing everything that they should have been doing. They were learning about the winching, they were using the winches, they were building log bridges, we were learning how to throw ropes across chasms and stuff like that. And there was, driving tests, and the best thing, which they normally use for Jaguars, is it's basically like speed trialing, but you have pairs of gates, which are pairs of posts, and you drive between them, and it's all done electronically, computer controlled. And what they do is it flags up the one you've got to drive through, and then shows you which one you've got to go through next. So you're constantly, it can be done in a flat field. I think for the Jaguars, it's done in a car park, obviously.
Okay, sort of like auto test.
Yes,
got you.
And okay. And it changes the route all the time, so you've got to, you, the person who's driving has to be knowing where the next one is, but the navigator is saying you've got to go left after that one and right after that one, and it's just flat out across this with the Defenders. It was flat out in the field, obviously, with the V8 auto box. Or it was absolutely fantastic. I think LRM had me driving on the front cover.
Yes, it was you driving on the front cover. I remember that cover, and I remember you showing it to me. Because we used to get LRM delivered to the office, didn't
yeah.
we, when we were on Land Rover owner, you know, keep an eye on the competition.
That's it.
And we were like, Neil's like, that's me driving that.
Yeah. But it's they are fantastic machines. And say the owners who were buying them were proper like enthusiasts, and such good fun to, you know, to work with and to, you know, enjoy the times with. Yeah.
Absolutely. I was going to say, actually, I had a similar experience on when I went and did, shortly after I first started on LRM, the Land Rover Classic Drives, where you could go and book and you get a tour of the facility at Wrighton, and then you go and drive some of the heritage fleet vehicles off-road. And obviously I was along in a, you know, press capacity, if you like, to do a story for the magazine, which was one of the first I wrote for LRM. But the people who paid to be there were all absolutely 100% invested and enthusiastic and asking questions and really, really, you know, they'd paid good money to be there, but
yeah,
absolutely loving every minute of it. It was really, really good to see.
And you know, the stuff that the company does put on, like the Land Rover Experience or the Classic Experience, stuff like that, so, you know, so good. You know,
yeah.
I mentioned earlier about the taking the paint off my 2.8 for the Land Rover Experience Scotland event, and that's called Under the Stars. I think they're doing it again this year. And it's where you get to drive the some of the trails they use for the Land Rover Experience training up there, a bit of camping, a bit of, you know, the Scottish Land Rover Club shows some of the trialing, so you can be involved in that. There's other little bits. And the Land Rover Experience centres around the country and around the world, they offer these great experiences that, yeah, it might be a couple of hundred quid, or I can't remember what the... The Understars wasn't that much, but for a sort of half day's taster on a new vehicle, it's well worth it just so you can see what these things are like anyway.
Definitely. Without giving too much away, we're hoping to take the, as I alluded to before, take the podcast on tour a little bit more this year. And one of the places we'll be swinging by is Land Rover Classic. So you'll be able to get the full menu straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
And also Patrick's going to come and have a chat as well, which will be cool. So we'll be able to see what he's been up to since going off on his latest adventures. So look forward to that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else there is to say, really.
I don't know. Apart from Steve's 90.
Yes, you looped that back round beautifully. Steve's, do you know what? I obviously knocked Steve when he sat next to me, and he's not here to defend himself.
But
he's actually, things are happening. I was over his earlier, actually.
Yeah.
Giving him a hand, moving some big bits of Land Rover about, and he's got a plan in his mind, and I don't have a shadow of doubt in my mind that by the end of this year, that will be pretty much done.
Excellent. Because I did notice, actually, in this, one of the things when I was flicking through online, I did notice that he had done an update in the mag.
Yes, yes.
So
his Writer's Rovers in the latest issue, the March issue, kind of gives a bit of a deeper insight into that Land Rover. So does a video that we've recently put on our YouTube channel. So check out Land Rover Monthly YouTube channel. Hit subscribe if you don't mind. Hate to be that guy. But yeah,
such an influencer.
Pack it. You're within punching distance. Not that I would ever hit you. But he will get it done. He's got the drive is there now.
Yeah, good.
I think we've
now he's seen your one like work or come back together very, very well. It wasn't as quickly as I hoped, because originally with Martin's Series 3, I said we can do this in a weekend, because I have been involved in weekend build before, and it has worked. Unfortunately, there were a few issues.
There were some stumbling blocks, weren't there?
Yes, which were unforeseen, but because, I mean, ultimately Martin did quite a lot of work in the evenings so that when the photos need to be done, it was...
And also, it's important to say that the reason... yeah, but like you say, we did come up against a few bits and pieces that weren't solvable in the time frame we were hoping to get it done, because we were hoping to get it back and running and driving in 2 days,
i.e.
strip it one day, have it running and driving by the end of the second day. But things like the bulkhead foot, which I mentioned earlier, that couldn't be sorted straight away because I didn't have one.
We messed around a lot with the brake pipes. The wiring, I'm not entirely sure about the wiring.
It's unique, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The connectors didn't work, so I had to kind of rework it without cutting any wires.
Neil, the patience of a saint, because I would have thrown my toys out of the pram. It did a fantastic job on the wiring, because some things didn't match up. I don't quite know why. There'd been some bad repairs on the main loom before, hadn't there? So we had to work that out. But the reason the Land Rover got a full coat of paint and not just the tub was because I had time while I was waiting for these other things.
That was my lovely paint, wasn't it?
It was the 30-year-old military NATO green.
Yeah, that was borrowed from a military, I don't know, I had a friend in the military at the time and I said, oh, can I have some paint? And he said, yes, all right. So he bought it out for me. I used some, back in the day I had my 2A, so that went military green, and I had a 109 truck cab. Well, no, it was a 109 soft top, and I ran it as a truck cab when I was trialing it. So it was used on both of those, but I had an unopened tin.
Yeah.
So I was amazed it wasn't a big lump of paint.
Well, you saw the video, didn't you?
Yes.
It was like 75% this weird, clear, gloopy liquid. And then the 25% at the bottom of the tin was the actual pigment, but it was absolutely rock solid.
Yeah.
I had to jam a piece of batten into it and like scoop it off the bottom of the tin. I was probably stirring it for about an hour and a half.
Really? But it worked though.
Well, the Land Rover's changed colour.
Yeah.
And I've still got some left, so leave it another 30 years, I'll be able to chisel it off the bottom of the tin and use it again. But yeah, good fun. And actually, the finished result, I think, was worth it.
I think, yeah, and I think you're right to keep the cappings as galvanised.
Yeah,
I think it
changed the look of it so much.
It makes it look more sort of a military / civilian rather than just an old military vehicle.
Well, it was missing so much of its military stuff when I bought it. Obviously, it's non-standard engine. All the 24-volt stuff is gone.
Yeah.
It's been converted to an alternator. There's lots of bits that make it not original. It's still got bits like the aerial boxes on the wings are still there, but I really wasn't precious about keeping the rest of its bits and pieces.
Yeah.
And actually, yeah, it is what it is. I really enjoy it. Yeah. It's a good, fun vehicle.
Great turn.
Well, thanks again for coming over and for chatting for an hour. I think we're about an hour. I don't actually know how long we've been waffling for, but it's been good. It's been good to catch up.
It has, yeah.
So, yeah, Neil, obviously, yes, we mustn't forget to say this. If you've got a new product you want to talk about and you want us to shout about in the magazine, please send us an email, editorial@lrm.co.uk, and we'll make sure to include it.
Yes, that's it, yeah. Because it will come through to Martin. Martin will send it to me, and I'll say, he will put some sort of sarcastic note on it, as he normally does when he forwards it to me, with some really, really bad English involved.
I don't know what you mean. But yeah, so it helps us, because we like to display the latest plethora of goodies to all our lovely readers, and it helps you because you get your product in the magazine. Everyone's a winner.
Exactly.
So don't forget to do that. Obviously, if you wouldn't mind to leave us a rating on your preferred streaming platform for this podcast, we'd love it if you did that. And also hit subscribe on the YouTube channel, follow us on socials, buy the magazine. You're all lovely. We love doing the podcast. We love meeting you out places and doing stuff and bumping into people at petrol stations.
Exactly.
So yeah, long may it continue.
Yep.
Thanks again for joining us, Neil, and we'll catch you on the next one.
Okay, bye.